Welcome to Bad Patient, Malpractice Makes Perfect. I'm Robin Donovan.
And I'm Laura Bears.
And we are two non-medical, non-experts sifting through this week's health news.
And this week's words are flu vaccine, standing desk, workplace wellness program, and awkward doctor.
And speaking of awkward, before we get started, I wanted to let you know that you can send us awkward and non-awkward emails by emailing hello@thebadpatient.com. If you have a topic or a question that you want us to discuss, you can send it there and we will research it in the most unprofessional way possible. We will research it in a way that's not as good as what it would be if it was like your doctor, but better than what it would be if it was like your grandmother. And then we'll help you figure it out.
I don't know. My grandmother's pretty cool.
Really?
No, that's not true. She has dementia. Well,
I don't know. Well, this is no longer... I was going to say I could out-Google your grandma any day, but then you said she has dementia, so now I feel bad.
Sorry. It was my bad. This is my joke.
You're like, ready, set, go. I start typing, and your grandma's like, wait, what? Who is this? Who are you? What are we doing?
Oh, that's so true. It's sad.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh. So what's your favorite buzzword from business, Robin? I know what your least favorite is. What's your favorite?
Oh, my favorite? I mean, to be honest, I am guilty of using opportunity instead of weakness, because I like that way of looking at it. Like, I like the optimism of it to say, like, yeah, like, there's an opportunity to, like, overhaul the website instead of saying, wow, the website's garbage and we really need to fix it. Because I just feel like it's better to say it that way. But having recently asked everyone I know on Facebook what their least favorite buzzword is, at least two people said opportunity for, like, a negative. And so I realized, no, we're guilty of using some of these things. Like someone said, on the same page, and I definitely say that one all the time. Like, do you say any of them?
I mean, I try to verify that we're at least in the same book. I mean, I feel like being on the same page might be an over too challenging for me. Are
we? Too much?
Yeah. I mean, we're on the same page, but we're in different books.
That sounds like the subtitle of the podcast.
It's actually the title of my autobiography.
We're on the same page, but God knows.
It's a really long title. It's a working title.
Speaking of titles, what's our first story?
Our first story comes from Wired, and it's Big Pharma Has the Flu. And it's talking about how the flu vaccine is insanely profitable for pharma companies, but for the general public is not super effective. As you may have noticed, Robin, the flu this season has been like really hard on people.
Well, I haven't noticed, Laura, because I've been sick with bronchitis and not the flu. But my understanding, like when I'm lying on the couch, is that other people are also lying on their couches. And so I understand that, you know, other people are having other experiences, which frankly sound like maybe they would be better than bronchitis. But I have heard.
I'm glad that you have the ability to empathize with other people, Robin. I'm glad we clarified that.
Really not at this point. No, actually, if anything, I'm somewhat annoyed by it, because if I try to tell people, like, the people I work out with, like, how come I haven't seen you in a month? And I'm like, oh, I was sick. Everyone says, did you have the flu? And then I have to say, no, actually, I didn't have the flu. I had a cold, I guess. And then it became this other thing. And then I had eye infections because it was the plague, but it wasn't the flu. Although, yes, I have heard that the flu is also bad. And it's very anticlimactic. You know, it'd be like if you said, I have a terminal diagnosis, and someone says, like, is it cancer? And you're like, no, it's this other thing, but it's also bad. You know, but everyone like just wants to hear about thing number one. There's a complaint in here somewhere. I'm not sure what it is.
I'm sorry, you don't have a terminal disease, Robin.
Oh, God. Don't say that.
I mean, you said I have a terminal disease, but it's not cancer. Like, I'm okay.
Well, I mean,
it seems like this escalated very quickly.
Listen, I overdid it in my workout yesterday, which is something that I was specifically instructed not to do. And now I'm a little tired and my brain is functioning at, like, I don't know what percentage of normal, but not 100%. And so you're just going to have to hang in there. You're going to have to be the one to fill in some blanks, right?
All right.
I can tell you, though, that this story I read on my own a day or two ago, and better yet, Maren McKenna and I are both in the same Association of Healthcare Journalists, and I've heard her speak. She is an excellent writer and a pretty cool lady. So that's my useful information for the day.
Thanks. Well, yeah. Shit. I thought I really got you on this one. So this article is talking about how the flu virus is infectious, and the reason why that this one in particular seems to be highly effective is that highly contagious is that the vaccine, when it arrived in Australia, was about 10%, and the CDC hasn't said a hard estimate of how effective it is in the U.S., but it seems to be about 30%, which means it's 70% not effective. And it's talking about how the flu vaccine makes pharma companies about $3 billion a year, and there isn't really a push from the pharma companies to find a more effective way of creating a vaccine like we do for, like, measles, mumps, and rubella.
Because it's like, it's not like it works or it doesn't work, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. The MMR vaccine, it works, you know, and if we had the wrong strain, it wouldn't work because those viruses aren't mutating, but this sneaky little flu devil every year, man.
Yeah. But they're also talking about there are some academic teams that are looking at the different proteins of the virus, which would not be changing, and that we could attack it that way. But there isn't really an incentive financially for these companies to do this kind of research because it's such big business and people have to get the flu shot every year. So it's continuous business. And the amount that you could get for, you know, one, two, or four times in a person's lifetime would be significantly less, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, it's basically make sense, like, for them. So what she's advocating for is that be like a Manhattan Project kind of research where it's important. And also she makes a good point that this is the 100th anniversary of the worst flu in known history, which was the 1918 influenza, which killed a million people in a little more than a year. 100 million.
Wow. Yeah. So, okay, what's the Manhattan Project?
So the Manhattan Project was what was used to build the atomic bomb in World War II.
Man, wow. So how did it, I don't know why I've never heard of this, but how did this work?
I mean, it was government funded, and they put all these research teams towards working towards one goal, and threw a lot of money and brain power at it, and it was a race against the Germans, you know, and the,
yeah,
so
we won. Yay. This is a little more benevolent than the Manhattan Project, but I think the problem in a nutshell is that a bad flu vaccine and a good flu vaccine, or an ineffective and an effective flu vaccine, are going to retail for the same price. And that's the problem. We're going to pay for the flu shot whether it works or not. And so we kind of trust the drug companies to say, we looked into this and we made our best guess. But the truth is that they could have a 5-year-old in that research lab flipping coins and picking viruses, and I don't know if we would know that. I mean, you could argue that since it's somewhat effective, they must have done something. But whether it's 70% effective or 70% ineffective, we go to the pharmacy and get the shot, and, you know, the insurance company reimburses them for whatever the cost of that is, which, frankly, I don't even know. Like, how much is an individual flu shot?
I'm not sure. Mine is free with my at work.
And I think they're all free without, looks like about between $30 and $40 if you don't have insurance.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Oh. It's a $3 billion industry.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting because the drug companies develop the vaccine and then sell the vaccine at a price that they set. And then it's like, we can't possibly, you know, make money off of this if we make a new one. Couldn't they just sell the vaccine for more money? I mean, I know we don't want that, but, like, theoretically, isn't that what they do when they develop new drugs?
Yeah, but it also gives the example of FluMist, which the company spent $1 billion creating, and that was in 2009. And as of 2017, the CDC advisory board recommended against using the spray at all, saying that the rate of effectiveness had sunk to 3%.
But FluMist, was that so that people didn't have to be exposed to the egg thing? Or is that something else?
I don't know. It was a nasal spray flu vaccine. I don't know. I had a nasal spray flu vaccine, but it was for swine flu.
Oh, for H1N1.
Yeah. You remember that?
Yeah, I got the vaccine as well. Yeah, I got it in grad school because they were saying, like, college campuses were especially, you know, subject to infection from it or whatever.
Yeah, I was part of the college program at the Walt Disney World Resort, and we had international travel. And at the bus stop at our housing unit, they had, like, the little thing, and they gave it to you and stuck it up your nose or whatever. And then after I got it, I read the possible side effects and included death. So, while I was driving to, like, you know, because, like, it's possible you could die or whatever, you know, right? You could have an allergic reaction. They just have to list everything, you know, like seizure or whatever. So I rode the little bus to Epcot, the experimental prototype community of tomorrow. and I held on to the paper so that way if I died, people would know what had happened. Because that is the things that I think about when I'm left alone with a piece of paper that says possible side effects is death.
Well, I did not have
any side effects from it, nor did I die. So it was less helpful to the people.
That's good to know. This would be a much different podcast if it was me and a dead person, I feel like.
I'm a good ghost.
Different questions. So what do people on the other side? Did you take a poll how many of them had gotten their flu shot? None of them? I was actually reading some articles today about how people die from the flu, because I was kind of wondering, and it's basically what you would think, just that they haven't, well, you can get pneumonia and die and other things, but in people who are healthy and often younger, it's just that the immune system overreacts, essentially, you know, and you have too much of a reaction and you kind of die from that. So, which in a way is almost like an argument for being less healthy, right?
Yeah.
They die because their immune system responded too strongly.
That's intense, man.
Yeah. So that's completely freaky. Right? Like, I don't know. My local Walgreens just put up a sign like a week or two ago that they're out of the flu vaccine, and I felt like 1% vindicated, you know, even though it, you know, what did it help for me? I don't even know, but
kept me from getting the flu and bronchitis at the same time.
Yeah. I was like, yeah, guys, got this vaccine in October. So, you know, I got that 30% odds working for me. All right.
Yeah, totally works.
It is kind of dumb. If you're going to get it, it's kind of dumb to get it in February. I mean, I better late than never, blah, blah, blah. But if you're going to get it, I mean, get it in early October. Like, might as well get the maximum effectiveness out of the thing. I don't understand why people wait until it's Christmas and then they go get it or whatever.
I don't know, maybe because somebody they knew got the flu.
Well, yeah, it's all reactionary.
Yeah. Get off my case, Mom.
Hey, listen, I happen to know that you never got yours because you told me, so...
Well, now it's stupid to get it, Robin. It's February.
And you already got the flu.
All right, you ready for the next article?
Yep.
So, it's from Bloomberg, and it's, do standing desk really help you lose weight? And this is about a study that just came out, and it's looking at whether or not standing desk can help you lose weight. And we know that sitting for a long period of time is bad for you. We also know that standing for a long period of time is bad for you. And so you just have to sit in like a pot of Jell-O for the rest of your life in order to be good.
I'm saying lying down. No one has told me I'm going to get cancer from lying down. And in fact, there's been so many studies showing that sleep can really help prevent Alzheimer's and depression and all sorts of nasty nasties. So I think I'm going to adopt a new position where I'm either working out or I'm lying down. Nothing in between.
So according to the study, standing desk can help you lose 22 pounds. As long as you don't sit down for 4 years.
Yeah. I read one of these stories today, too. But the story I read was saying, do they help you lose weight? And they kind of said, not really, you know.
Yeah. The researchers found that you lose calories. You burn more calories by standing. And it is 54 calories for a 6-hour period.
And I read somewhere that men burn twice as many, the men in this one study burned twice as many calories as women. So it's like the study had said, or the article said, it was like eating an orange. And I was like, oh, does that mean if I'm female, it's like a half an orange? I'll just not eat that extra bite of the banana or whatever. All right. Like, and sit down. Like, this is not worth it.
Yeah. So this was a meta study where they reviewed over 700 studies, but only 46 met their standards.
Wait a minute. So 650 plus studies, they were like, nah, 654
did not meet the rigorous standards to be included in their review. They were snobby about it. Okay.
Yeah. Wow.
And it only looks at measures for sitting and standing, and we're careful not to include other calorie burning behaviors. And it showed that, it looked at more than 1,100 people who use standing desks, and that it shows that it does help, but it's not super effective. But, if you're standing, you're also more likely to be moving too. So,
maybe.
Yeah.
I guess you're more likely to, like, shift on your feet and stuff, whereas sitting, you're just kind of, like, stuck in one place.
Yeah.
The other thing is, this is just talking about weight loss. There could be other benefits. You know, I've thought about maybe potential circulatory benefits, like avoiding blood clots and stuff. Because you know how they say, like, you're at risk for deep vein thrombosis after long flights because you're sitting so still for so long and things like that. I've wondered if standing desks could be like healthful in that way. So
are you suggesting that the airline instead just have standing?
Oh my God. No, because you know what would happen then? The airline would be like, oh, well, if everyone's standing up, they only need 18 inches of space. And right now we're giving them 26 inches of space. And so you would end up with your nose touching the tip of someone else's nose because that's how close you would be. And then if you were like a woman and a petite woman, you would end up like with your arms wrapped around yourself in an attempt to, like, you know, there would just be no room because there'd be some guy, it's always a guy, who's like, I need to read my Wall Street Journal with both pages all the way unfolded.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
For some reason, I'm holding my arms out right now as if I'm showing you. Even though
Thanks, Robin.
You cannot see me. I think
it's an excellent representation for our podcast.
I think that I've just been on one too many flights with business people. I'm trying to tone down my sexism for this portion of my statement, but no, just one too many flights where someone was reading a newspaper and insisted on like unfurling it into my lap. And I just thought, like, I understand there's no way for you to read this newspaper if you, well, actually there is, but you know, that even if they have to unfold it and then fold it over, I'm like, people, for God's sake, like, now is not a good place to read something that's 4 feet wide. Like, do you understand? Your seat is 6 inches wide.
Do you read the newspaper that they're holding? Because clearly they want you to read it.
I should. I should be like, hey, can you go back to that?
No.
I wasn't quite
what
done.
What you should do is just use your finger to trail where you are. Because clearly,
or be like, hey,
they want,
can you flip?
They want interaction.
they want a what?
They want an interaction. They want you to. They yeah. want you to read too. Reading is fun.
Yeah,
the mental
reading is fun. I should encourage. I of all people should encourage the consumption of news media. What am I doing?
I mean,
I should bring my own newspapers. I should bring my own newspaper. When they unfold theirs, I should unfold mine, preferably, you know, overlapping, and then just shuffle around the pages a lot. Well, some airlines, I don't know if they still do it, but we're like giving out newspapers. And I'm like, can you give out a magazine or something? Like, here's your 4-inch seat. Let's give you something that, you know, like, vroom. I don't know. There's a lot to complain about on airlines, but my most egregious one recently was this guy who took his arm and like he set his arm, he was in front of me and he set his arm on the top of his seat with his hand kind of dangling over. And you know how, like, the little TVs are in the back of the headrest in front of you? So, like, I'm watching TV and stuff, and, like, his hand is, like, right in front of my face. It was so crazy that I actually, like, took a picture. Wait, did I send it to you? I probably did.
Maybe. Did you hold his hand? He clearly wanted you to hold his hand. He was nervous, Robin, and you ignored his pleas for help.
Or maybe he needed a pen. You know, I should have just stuck something in. It was just so bizarre because
you should have put your trash in his hand.
Like my little peanut wrapper.
Yeah. Although he might have been
sometimes
allergic, it could have been deadly.
Oh my gosh. So I was on a flight with a woman with a severe peanut allergy who was wearing or who proceeded to put on a mask like in front of us. But no one told us before we got on the plane. So we were on the plane for like 15 or 20 minutes before the like attendant came around and said, hey, just so you know, there's a woman in the row behind you. She's really severe nut allergy. If you have any nuts with you, if you wouldn't mind, you know, like not eating those until we get to the destination. And I don't know. I actually had nuts in my bag, which made me incredibly nervous because I thought, one, what if I had pulled these out? You know, like that seems like something that maybe you'd want to tell people in advance. Two, I was just worried that somehow the nuts would get to her. You know what I mean? I was just like,
out of your bag, open themselves up and fly into her mouth?
Well, they were just in like a plastic baggie. They weren't sealed like in an airtight container. And if you're severely allergic, yeah, like a little bit could do it, right? And I was like, oh boy. So she ended up being okay. But I don't know. I felt bad for her because she clearly was feeling self-conscious. You know, she like offered to buy us all a snack. And I was like, I am actually an adult who in a move that's going to shock us all can go 4 hours without eating. So anyway,
all right.
I'm not sure what the point is other than that airlines are really, really starting to take advantage of our liberties in terms of personal space.
Yeah, for sure. So no standing desks on the airplane. Noted. Robin said no.
I feel like they're just going to use it against us.
Oh, yeah,
somehow.
For sure.
Okay, also, did you know that at an airplane conference, they demoed this, like, seat that was every other seat facing a different way? So in your row, you're facing back, your person adjacent to you is facing forward, so that they could jam more people in, like your legs would kind of because then the people in front of you, like you're all kind of facing each other, but you're staggered. It looked like airplane hell to me.
All right, so we're not flying on that plane. Got it.
I think they just demoed it at some kind of aviation trade fair or something, and then some intrepid journalist from, it might have been Forbes, you know, wrote the story so that people like me who fly a lot could see it and go, oh my God, that would be so terrible. Because, you know, there's nothing that gets more clicks than capitalizing on people's fears about the future, right? It's like your worst nightmare is like, could that actually come true? Are they going to start putting 6 people in a row? They're getting rid of the bathrooms on the plane? You know, they're going to start doing 1 peanut per bag? Ah!
Oh no, Robin.
That's okay. I can't eat the peanuts anyway.
It's true.
How do you get wheat into a peanut?
I don't know. Seems like you gotta try.
Just someone tweet Southwest for me and just ask them, is it really cheaper to coat the peanuts with a wheat-based coating? Is that, you know, you take something that's already an allergen and you add another allergen to it. There's no way that that's cheaper than just serving plain peanuts. I can't understand it. Maybe they do that so the peanuts don't age or something. I think there's got to be a reason, right?
I don't know. Google it, Robin. Let me know what you find.
It's like the only thing I don't like about Southwest.
Well, there's got to be something. What I don't like about Southwest is there's this woman who flies it who complains about the peanuts being covered in wheat.
I do not complain. You know why? Because they give me unlimited Fritos.
Oh, that's fun.
Unlimited. You can have as many as you want.
Oh.
That's what unlimited means. I wasn't sure if you knew, so I was going to woman-splain it to you.
Thank you for explaining that for me. There's no way that I would have figured that out on my own, so I appreciate it.
What
it means,
Laura, is if you eat one package, you want another package, they bring you the second package, you eat the second package, you want a third package, you want a fourth package, you can have as many packages as you want.
I like it.
I haven't really tested this theory.
You should.
I know. Well, they sent me these 4 drink coupons in the mail. I'm not a big drinker, but I think if I was going to test that theory, it'd be fun to test it on the same day that I use all 4 drink coupons.
I have flown on Southwest on a holiday. On Thanksgiving, we flew. And they give a free alcoholic beverage to those who are 21 and up on, like, Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And we were sitting up in the front, and we were friendly to the flight attendant. And the flight attendant clearly was going to have fun and just kept handing us alcoholic beverages.
So what did you have?
I don't know. He was just handing things to me. It was like mixed drinks. Like, you know, they asked, like, what mixed drink you wanted or, you know, what alcoholic beverage, because they announced that, you know, they were free or whatever. And I think I said, like, I don't even know, the margarita or whatever. And then he just kept handing me and my husband and the people on the other side more and more drinks. I think it was a 2-hour flight and we had like 4 or 5 drinks.
Wow.
Luckily when we landed we took Uber.
Yeah.
We had a great time. Flying on Thanksgiving was amazing.
That's such a good policy, because I bet everyone's kind of angry
on
Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. And we were flying to Orlando for vacation, it wasn't like we were flying home to go visit people and family like we should have been.
There is nothing. Well, karma worked in reverse then.
Yeah.
I want to say there is nothing more painful than taking, like, a flight out of Orlando, like an evening flight out of Orlando, and it's like all the kids and they're leaving Disney and they're going back home and they're exhausted and they've had so much junk food and their parents have just given up on parenting them, which I think is a legitimate choice at that point. And they're just, you know, there's just awfulness. And I'm not usually someone who complains about children on planes at all. Like, I feel like those complaints are so overdone and that most of the time the worst behavior on planes, in my experience, is from adults. Kids, like, they cry for 10 minutes and then they fall asleep. Like, all children.
Except for that one kid who cries the entire time.
I mean, you occasionally get the kid who, like, kicks the seat the whole time or whatever. But I feel like most kids lose interest in whatever thing they're doing that might be annoying to those around them. Whereas, like, an adult doing an annoying thing has the stamina and the persistence to keep doing it for, like, the whole flight, right?
It's fair.
Like, that guy with his big hairy arm. I mean, that was, like, 3 or 4 hours. How could you possibly be comfortable with your arm over your head for that long?
I don't know.
That dude had, like, incredible, like, flexibility in his rotator cuff, right? Or whatever.
He was just showing off.
Yeah. I was like, what are you, like, a major league pitcher? The shoulder never gets tired.
All right. Our next article comes from WBUR.org. And its study finds virtually zero benefit from workplace wellness program in first year.
And I love that the picture is a female doctor taking some guy's, maybe, what could be a guy's blood pressure. And he's got his shirt off. I hope so, too. They got to, you know, to get that cuff on your arm, you can't be wearing anything on your torso at all. They got to have.
Apparently not. Does your employer offer a reward program for, like, a wellness? Do you have a wellness
They do.
Program?
Yeah, we get money for getting a physical, for quitting smoking, for belonging to a gym, and I think it's just those three. And then we have some kind of competition to lose weight every year. And actually, the guy in my office who won it last year is, like, the thinnest person in the office. Like, before and after, so.
That checks out.
I think he gamed the system, which, frankly, I find very impressive.
Funny.
Do you?
We do. If we participate in the wellness program, I work at a place that has a gym, and they'll waive the gym membership fee. And
sweet.
You can get up to $130 at the end of the year if you hit, like, all the marks. Mm-hmm. For it. But a recent study shows that the $8 billion industry in the first year makes no significant benefit at all. So not
in the first year.
Yeah. Well, no lower medical costs, no fewer sick days, no higher productivity. None of that happens. And part of the reason why is because the people who are inclined to participate in these voluntary programs are people who are already healthier.
Okay, this makes total sense to me because one of my favorite airports is Minneapolis, and they have a treadmill in the airport that is sponsored, I think, by either the Heart Association or the Diabetes Association, and they're, you know, obvious conflict of interest there. Obvious interest there. And part of the using the treadmill is they ask you to take they have a little computer there and they want you to take a survey. And I always take the survey and think somewhere I'm messing up someone's numbers because they say, like, how tall are you? What do you weigh? What are your health concerns? Have you ever been screened for this and this and that? And of course I'm always like, I'm healthy. I'm da-da-da-da, you know, and so, like, they're not catching anything by screening me ever. But because I feel bad about that, I always do this. There's another survey at the end, and I give them, like, 5 stars for everything, and I tell them this is the best half an hour I've ever spent at an airport, and, like, hoping that, because I want there to be more treadmills in the airport. So, but it's the same system, right? I'm probably not the person that they were hoping would use that treadmill.
Yeah. You're ruining everything, Robin. The episode's just been called
No, I'm not.
Robin Ruins Everything.
I'm not, because hardcore, no one else really uses it. Like, no one's ever waiting for it when I get off. I'm never waiting to get on it. There's only one, I think, maybe two.
Yeah.
There's no line for this, all right?
Yeah, because let me tell you. First of all, I've never flown out of that airport. Second of all, if for whatever reason I did, I would not be on that.
Well, I like that airport because it's kind of smaller, so it's quieter, and they also have good gluten-free food options, so they tend to be on time. Unlike, let me just name them here, O'Hare, Atlanta, okay, these airports where timeliness just goes to die. I'm not sure why I'm so wound up about air travel today. I haven't been on a plane in, like, months. Anyway.
So the research shows that there isn't really any difference between offering $100 or $200. You get the same level of participation. And, like, ultimately the purpose of it is to point out some of the pitfalls of this type of program to make it better, and allow for greater participation.
You know what they should do? They should just say, if, like, take all the people who sign up the first year and be like, you got $100. We will give you $500 if you get someone in your workplace who didn't sign up last year to go to the, like, to come with you to the gym once a month all year or something. You know what I mean? Like, that's what you need to do, is, like, you've got to get people to incentivize other people or something.
Absolutely,
like that.
Robin. However, that's not what this study was about.
If I could get
a really good check, that's a really good idea. You should definitely let the wellness program industry know about it. I feel like that's a good plan.
I mean, it is. Yeah, because you better bet if I could get $500 for making you work out once a month, I would just call you every single day.
Yeah, and then at the end of the year, you would not have $500.
Oh, I would have the $500.
You would not have $500, nor a podcast with me.
I would just come to your house. I'd be like, Laura, I can't podcast unless you're walking in place as we podcast. Try to hold the mic steady.
Unfortunately, I don't think we'll be able to podcast this year.
Well, for $500, I mean, I might be willing to stop podcasting.
You're a cheap date.
I don't know. I like the podcast, so. Okay, so. Okay, I think, in seriousness, the drawback on this study is, like, maybe it's not effective within a year, but I would bet that it actually would be effective over a longer time period.
You think? Because I don't think that people that are unhealthy, such as myself, will ever join the wellness program. I know this because today I got another email about the wellness program, and I opened it, I read it, I looked at it, I clicked on it, I saw the days, then I had to fast, and then it was going to, like, prick my finger to check for, like, cholesterol, and I thought, I'm 30, I should be okay for another, like, 2 years, and I deleted it.
Well, that does kind of seem like a high barrier to entry. Yeah, ours is like, you just have to get your doctor to sign a letter saying that you got a physical, and you just tell them that you joined a gym. I don't know how they would check.
I don't know either, but I also don't
kind of hope they do check
a general practitioner, so I don't have a doctor to go do a physical with. Yeah.
Well, to be fair, I don't either this year, but I might try to get one. Or, like, have an OBGYN do it. That's, like, wellness enough.
Yeah. I also work on a tobacco-free campus, and I saw somebody sitting in their car smoking. That's all that has done. They just now sit in their car and smoke, so now their car smells like tobacco.
Wait. Are they allowed to sit in the car and smoke?
I don't know, but that's what they're doing.
Because I would think that a tobacco-free campus would mean, like, anywhere. Because what does that even do? You sit in the car and smoke, then you get out opening the car door and the smoke comes. It's not like your car is a vacuum.
No, but it's not like I'm standing next to their car waiting to breathe it in either.
Yeah.
But I might have walked it by the door that they stood by, you know?
So what do you think?
They offer tobacco cessation. Using tobacco classes or whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, that person clearly wasn't using it. Or maybe they were. Mm. Then, yeah. You know, it's a struggle. It's an addiction or whatever.
It is.
But it is. I just thought it was interesting that this is a tobacco. I mean, who is walking around enforcing that rule? Nobody. There's nobody. Right. Like, what are they going to do? Wag their finger at you if they find you?
Yeah.
Like, you're not like, made away that. So
I'm sure it's like,
at the worst, what would happen is they would drive across the street and then smoke there in somebody else's parking lot. Like, this person was clearly going to smoke. Like,
yes. Well, and that's the thing, in a way, that almost makes me feel bad. I mean, smoking is more addictive than crack cocaine, so it's hard for people to quit, and I've watched people really struggle to quit. So part of me is like, man, like, make a designated space so if they need to smoke, they don't have to feel like a criminal. On the other hand, secondhand smoke is bad for people, and I really have found that those rules where you have to go outside are of limited impact, because as someone who likes to run on a somewhat busy street near my house, there's like a block where I always get a lung full of smoke because there's always people crowded around the door. Like, they're not 50 feet away from anything, right? They're 2 feet outside the door, like, and they're smoking, and there's like no way to like avoid them. So
yeah,
I don't know. You know what supposedly is really effective for quitting smoking?
What?
Hypnosis.
Okay.
Yeah. I know someone personally who just did it, and I have a friend who's actually a hypnotist, and he told me once he told me once that smoking is one of the things where it's like, that's like the easiest thing. Like, he, you know, he'll work with people all different types of issues and challenges, and he said like smoking is like, oh, it's so effective, you know, and like those are the ones where he's like, I got this. So
that's awesome.
I know. I love the idea of that. I like the idea of something that works, that doesn't cost $1 million. And yeah, and it's just so cool when you see someone, you talk to someone who's quit, and like how excited they are, and they feel better, and they look better, and you know, it like gives me hope.
Good. All right, you ready for our last article?
Yeah.
Our last article comes from Shareably. And his colleagues laugh at awkward doctor for writing name on cap. Don't realize it saves lives. So this is about awkward doc. So
Shareably. What? Shareably. I guess they're hoping all their content is shareable.
Yeah. So this is an article about a doctor in Sydney who writes his name and his job on his cap for like surgery. And the reason Why? Is because when everybody's wearing a cap and a mask and the same outfit, it's really hard to tell who's who, right?
Oh, so it like clears up any type of potential mix-up in the operating room?
Well, it helps reduce the chance of delays and misidentification between colleagues who are wearing surgical scrubs and have masks on. And it can be critical in surgery that even seconds or minutes can cause issues. Also, like, you might not really know these people, so being able to call them by their name and then having what their position is helps with that.
I like it, and I like the photos that go with this article. There's something that is very humanizing about this. It's kind of like a touch of silliness, I think. Mm-hmm. Instead of, you know, people behind masks, and it's impersonal, and you know, dealing with people who we've relegated to patient status in like a very depersonalized way. Like, I know you can kind of see like they're all smiling like they're having fun. And I just like this. It's making me smile, too.
Yeah. So it's a challenge. It's a theater cap challenge.
Which hashtag. Is a hashtag. But you got to spell theater the ending in R-E instead of E-R because it's a non-U.S. thing.
Yeah. So they're looking for ways to reduce errors. And also, like, when you point to someone, like, it's hard to know if they're pointing at you or the person who's standing directly behind you. And if you don't say their name, then it can be, you know.
Yeah. And listen to this. It says, Hackett said, you know, who's Hackett? We got to tell people.
The doctor?
The doctor who started it. Mm-hmm. Dr. Rubb said he's witnessed delays in chest compressions because those in the operating room didn't know who the clinician asked to initiate the compressions because no one was referred to by name. So in other words, person's lying on the table dying, like clinician in charge goes, start chest compressions, makes a vague gesture, and everyone's like, what, me? Him? That? What? Who's doing it? Am I doing it? Okay, I'm doing it. Okay, don't do it. I'm going to do it. And then that, like, 6 seconds, there's, like, no oxygen going to that person's brain, right?
Yeah.
Ugh, it's so simple. It's so genius.
Right?
We should just have everyone who graduates from medical school just tattoo that stuff on their forehead. Although, I guess then the cap would cover it up.
No tattoos necessary, people.
All right. Well, see, here I thought it was going to require a facial tattoo, which really would be something of a sacrifice.
Once you get your job, you can't change it. You can't change it. It's on your face.
I love it. Well, I mean, the statistics on surgical errors like and preventable deaths in surgery are pretty scary. And, you know, I mean, we're all only human, but I think all of us want to think that we're not going to die because someone sneezed while holding our aorta in a clamp and their finger slipped or something. I don't know. That's a terrible example. But, you know, you want to think, like, my death is going to be meaningful or at least unavoidable. Not like, oh, well, we were supposed to give you this antibiotic, but we forgot and now you're in septic shock. So all your organs are shutting down. Like, too bad. So sad. You die. Like, it's a very harsh reality.
Damn. You go quick.
just took that to its ultimate conclusion as quickly as possible.
I like it. I like it a lot. So, Robin, what's your current medical fascination?
Well, actually, this goes along with your surgery story. So, I was at a bookstore checking out magazines because the publication that I run is, you know, needed some design ideas, and we were just trying to like to kind of freshen things up a little bit on a new issue we're doing. So I wanted to just peruse around and see what other magazines were looking like. And I happened across an article in one of the magazines, which I haven't even read yet, about like surgery as a placebo or surgery being like such a strong – surgery has such a strong association with helping that – even if you don't get the surgery, if you think you had surgery, you can have excellent outcomes. And I know of one study where this was done in knee patients. So they just made a small incision. They made the incision on everyone, but on some people they did this arthroscopic procedure and on other people they didn't. But everyone had the little cut, so no one really knew. And the outcomes were the same. So it's terrifying. And I think you and I have even talked about this before, like how freaky it would be if you thought you were getting surgery and you didn't get it. But just think of how strong that mind-body connection is that absolutely. You could, I mean, that just makes me want to be like, please, if I ever need surgery, knock me out, make a little incision, stitch it up, and then just give me a month. Because it would be so good to avoid surgery if you don't absolutely need it.
Okay. I'll do that the next time you need surgery, yeah. Robin.
So it's this whole thing about sham surgeries, and I'm not going to tell you the original article that I found because it's in a magazine that was recently accused of not paying its freelance writers, and I forgot about it, and I bought the magazine, and I'm so mad. But I found a similar story elsewhere. It's in 538, and the title is Surgery is One Hell of a Placebo, and it's by Christy Ishwandan, which I think I have been a fan of before on the podcast. So she's awesome. That's a good story to check out. And there's also Scientific American did a piece on it called How Fake Surgery Exposes Useless Treatments. So anyway, if you just Google fake surgery, you'll come across all this data and it's just fascinating. So what would you want, Laura? Like would you be willing to like have a fake surgery, you know, if it could prevent you from needing the real deal?
No.
If you have signed up for surgery, you want the real thing?
Yeah.
I don't.
You're weird.
No, think about it.
Don't stab me.
Well, they're not going to stab you. They're going to make like a tiny cut.
They're stabbing me.
Well, they're going to stab you either way.
I don't want to be stabbed. Well, if I'm not going to have surgery, then don't stab me.
But that's not an option.
Well, it is. There's only two options.
Well, no. I mean, I'm saying you're doing it, right?
No.
Like something happens and they're like, Laura, you need surgery.
If I need surgery, then I need surgery.
Well, the problem is we have never really been able to test all the surgeries, so we don't know if the surgery is actually going to help you.
I understand what you want. I don't want to participate in this study, though.
Well, yeah, there is something a little off about, like, someone's gonna cut you for no reason.
I'm for good.
Science. But I mean, that's how every study works, right? Somebody gets a placebo, somebody gets the drug. Like, that's how cancer trials work.
Yes, and I'm not currently participating in any clinical trials. Ever.
What?
I don't know why I said currently.
You are. Yeah. I'm not currently. Listen, I wrapped up my last clinical trial last week. I'm done with those. Well, here's my question for you. What current event do you think is having an impact on health news this week?
I think that the influenza is having an impact on health news this week. Because there's a shit ton of articles about the damn flu.
I know.
I kept scrolling. I don't want to learn about the flu. Tell me something new.
Yeah. And the flu is kind of like old news at this point. Like, we get it. And I feel like the media has kind of latched on to the fact that more people are dying from the flu this year and creating a perception in people's minds that it's like, that the flu was never deadly before and now is incredibly deadly. And the truth is, the flu has always been deadly, which is why some people have been trying to encourage other people to get flu shots.
Yeah, but you're just trying to get the $500 so that I go to the gym with you. I'm on to your that game, wellness sister.
That wellness program doesn't exist yet.
Oh, okay.
But it should. You know, our company does a thing where you can get, like, the most money you can get is if you stop smoking, once in a lifetime benefit. And I've thought, how long does one have to smoke to be considered a smoker? Because I'll start and stop. I mean, just
what if,
like,
it gets you addicted, though?
I'm not going to be addicted. I'm going to be crying the whole time.
It's more like, addictive than crack cocaine.
Yeah, okay. But in a way, I think that might be misleading because you can be hooked on crack for life after, you know, after one hit. Like, that's an actual thing. I don't think that cigarettes have that same property. So, like, I believe it's like once you're addicted, the pull toward the substance is the same. But I don't think that it's as pick-upable. Although, that should be my health question for next week, because I really don't know, but that's just my anecdotal evidence. Like, do you know anyone who's like, I smoked one cigarette and then I just smoked them, like, then I couldn't stop? Like, I smoked one cigarette and the next morning woke up and thought, I'm going to die if I don't have another cigarette?
No, but to be fair, I've never met anybody who told me that they had crack cocaine once and then they thought they were addicted for life either. So,
well,
neither scenarios has happened for me, unfortunately. So,
I
don't think
that's
scientific.
Well, I mean, none of this is scientific and it's all anecdotal. But, I mean, you know, I used to have that job where I was working with people who were homeless, like, just when they were coming out of the hospital. It was like a medical facility. Mm-hmm. Small medical facility. And I guess I didn't hear, most people's stories didn't delve into like becoming hooked after a single hit, but it did seem like a setup in many people's cases where like life wasn't going great before they tried crack. And a lot of people felt that they had, you know, what people have termed an addictive personality. Like, I remember one person telling me, like, if I get a bag of M&Ms and it's a 1 pound bag, I'm just going to eat the whole thing. You know, it's like everything I do the whole thing. But God knows, I believe that it is highly addictive because I saw people in terrible physical condition. I mean, partially blind, not able to walk, organ failure, like really truly ill people who would still go out and use drugs again. They just couldn't stop, you know, and they had support at their actual fingertips, right? Living in a facility where there's a nurse 24/7, where there's a social worker 40 hours a week, like all the care was provided free of charge. Substance abuse counseling was offered, although granted, you know, I don't know that it was all top of the line if everything was free, but you know, it wasn't nothing. And you would just see people that, you know, someone would tell them, if you do this again, like, your odds of death are 50%. You're going to trash, you know, whatever such and such organ that's about to shut down, like, whatever. And just would do it not only once, but time and time again. Or people that you could say to them, if you walk out this door and you go use this substance, you're going to lose out. We have this apartment for you. It's paid for a year. You're getting it. You know, it's yours. You just can't do drugs from now till then. And they would still leave. And honestly, I think that in some ways is a failing of these programs, because like relapse is part of the disease of addiction, and to insist that no one relapse would be like telling a person with a cold not to sneeze in many ways. But what I took away from that experience is just like how powerful addiction is. So if cigarettes are more addictive than that, God.
Then don't, it's not worth the money, Robin.
Well, yes, that's obviously true. Thanks, Mom.
You're welcome.
Well, I think that's about enough bad patienting for me for one day. Laura, is there anything crucial that you think we missed? I mean, we had a lot to say about plane travel today.
No, I think we hit everything.
I think we've covered all of our bases. So if you'd like to connect with us, we are online at thebadpatient.com. You can listen on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. You can email us at hello@thebadpatient.com. We are also on Twitter @thebadpatient. The best compliment you can give us is to share the podcast with your friends and ask them to give it a listen as well. Before we get going, we want to thank Evan Schaefer, our composer, for our theme song.
Thanks, and
you can
Evan.
Listen to his music, thanks, at soundcloud.com/Evan Schaefer. Until next time, we are bad patients.
Malpractice makes perfect.